This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition, we're featuring an interview with Eric Clapton. He has a new CD called Pilgrim. Our interview was recorded in 1989.
A couple of years ago, you did an interview with Robert Palmer for, I guess it was in the New York Times. Maybe it was in Rolling Stone. New York Times? Okay. And you had told him that John Landau had written a review of a Cream concert.
That's right.
And he gave it a really bad review. And you said that the Ring of Truth knocked you backwards, and that's when you decided that you wanted to leave Cream. Why did that review have such a profound effect on you?
Well, it was tied in with a long, in-depth interview, which I had done in Sausalito. If my memory serves me right, I had been flying high, and we'd been playing the film where we're stoned and everything. And really, we were God's gift to music, you know, and I was blathering on about all this. And on the next page was this fantastic review, and I was summed up as being the master of the cliché. And juxtaposed with this interview, the effect was astonishing. And I remember reading the article in a restaurant. I was with some friends in Boston, and I read the whole thing in silence, and the other guys were just sitting around having a conversation. I stood up to go to the loo and passed out. I mean, it had that severe. And I remember waking up, not coming around in the restaurant. I was taken, carried out of the restaurant and put in someone's house, and waking up thinking, what the hell is going on? And immediately thinking, I've got to get out of this. You know, that whole thing was right. And I've been playing this awful game. A musical game for too long, and I've got to leave that band and this and that and plan a new life. It had a devastating effect on me.
Was it because you were embarrassed, insulted, or because you felt that you needed to be moving in a new musical direction?
The last part is what... I mean, I was ashamed because I think inside I had known for quite a while that we were really... We were selling the audiences short, you know. We were going on stage stoned, and we were playing just kind of meaningless, a lot of the time anyway, meaningless, endless solos, and people were swallowing it. And I was starting to feel rather ashamed of the whole thing because we were resting on our laurels, to say the least. You know, we weren't sitting down thinking about new ways to write songs or developing the music of the band. We had got stuck in a rut by that point.
Mm-hmm. So you did leave Cream because of that?
Yes, I did. I mean, I said to the guys, I've got to leave. You know, I've got to do something else or just stop. You know, I don't want to do this anymore. And I think we'd approached this situation for other reasons before. You know, we were constantly having rows about one thing or another, and then we talked to the manager about it, and he decided we should do one farewell tour, you know, and make a farewell album, which is what we did. And at that point, actually, funnily enough, as it does happen in many other walks of life, we became suddenly very much closer. And I think during the farewell concert we did at the Albert Hall, there was a great deal of regret and nostalgia on my part, and I wasn't sure if I was doing the right thing.
Looking back, what do you think?
Yes, I think now, after all this time, I think I had a lot of other things to do that I couldn't have done if I'd stayed with that band.
You, not too long after that, I guess, formed Blind Faith. I think for the first Blind Faith concert, there was like an audience of 36,000. What was it like for you to go from starting off playing in small clubs and ending up playing these huge concerts, you know, stadium concerts? It's quite a transition, and it was right at the very beginning of that period where concerts got that big. I mean, so it's not something you could have been expecting.
I think we were sort of lulled into a full sense of security there. I think we assumed that this particular concert we did was going to be a one-off, you know, then we would go back to clubs, or at least it would be interspersed, you know. We were probably going to do, in our minds anyway, you know, big halls now and then mainly clubs. But of course, halfway through the American tour, the whole thing started to get very jaded because we were only playing stadiums, and we weren't ready. We had barely enough material to do, you know, an hour and a half. And outside of that, we were empty, you know, and that wasn't the way it wanted to be. We wanted to be, at least Steve Winwood and myself, wanted to be like a very integral band that could play for hours, you know, and learn lots of songs and just have a whole wealth of material, something that you would take years to develop. And, of course, we never were given that chance.
You eventually took a hiatus from music, and you spent a couple of years doing a lot of drugs.
Yeah, basically doing a lot of drugs, yeah. I think, I can't remember where it started. I've always been, I've always had a leaning towards addictions, you know, one way or another, an obsessive personality, to say the least. And even when I was 16, everyone, in fact, it was like peer pressure. Everyone was taking amphetamine or different kind, or drinking wine. You know, it was part of life, it seemed to be.
This is Fresh Air, I'm Terry Gross. What artist
I realize
doesn't
now
feel
that I was going to end up,
would improve,
you know,
if
on,
only
on,
they
on
had
the heap.
More time, more space,
and
more
I pretty
money.
Well got close to that.
In Mary Gordon's new novel, early 70s, a woman painter meets up with an admirer who offers himself as her patron, muse, model, and lover.
It started
the
out
novel
the way
explores
it always
the impact
starts
this
out, you know,
relationship
a joint
has
or taking
on
a few
the painter's
pills.
Work and every other aspect
and for some
of her
people,
life,
it
from
escalates
money to
very quick. For me, it took a long time.
In fact, one of the issues we'll talk about is the dilemmas Gordon faced in writing about sex.
Gordon is the author
of the novel.
And I regret it,
payments,
that's for sure.
Of women,
did you have like a bottoming out moment where you
her recent
think, this
memoir,
is it,
A Shadow
I've
Man,
to change.
Was about discovering that her father,
yeah,
when she
I think,
was seven, had fabricated much of the story of his life.
It's funny because it's difficult
Here's
to be, I mean, when you are that stoned, it's difficult to be,
the painter, Monica, is
to
in the
stand
gallery,
outside of yourself and see how far you've gone,
work.
You know, because
She's
you're so
discussing
wrapped up
one of her paintings called The
Other people can tell you,
which shows a man in his underwear in a state of arousal.
And it happened to
that
me.
That night when I was giving the slide talk, I
at
spoke
some
a
point,
bit about
I'd had
the
friends come and stay with me, and they were virtually like my
no
jailers.
Really,
you know, they were making sure that I didn't harm
what
myself.
They wanted to hear
I
was about
taking
was painting
heroin,
an erection.
I was taking,
did I have a model? And who was he?
Which is a powerful,
what did
like,
I do
Quaalude,
to give him one?
Equivalent.
Was it just one or a lot
drinking,
of them? And how did they last?
Lots of hard
Except,
liquor.
Except, of course, they were too decorous to ask those questions right out.
I remember seeing myself,
and this is true,
sitting in my car at dawn, totally naked, trying to start it.
But I wasn't going
to
dwell on that.
And what I was doing, I was trying to escape
model,
from my own house where these people
work.
Were trying to look after me.
I did say that, and
it
got a
thank
big
God,
laugh.
One of the
also,
guys had
I
taken
said,
out the road
I was painting
the
from memory
I was just
in the great tradition
the
of romantic
car,
landscape
totally
painting.
I don't know where I was going to go.
The remembrance of things
But I had
past.
A flash then that
Another
things had gone
laugh.
A little too far.
I'm sure
so
there's
I,
an eternal punishment designed for people who are fed by the big laugh.
What did you do?
Who'll say anything, almost anything to get it.
I went to an acupuncturist.
Or maybe not. Maybe it's not worthy of damnation at all.
London,
maybe it's a very pure act, a very generous
a
act. You give yourself up to your audience, you're all together, carried up on a wave,
current
and
from
you really
one ear to
do
the other
lose yourself.
Induced a
Sometimes
sort of
when I'm in the
a
middle
mild,
of going
natural
for the big
narcosis,
laugh
which
or the
took
next
away
big
the
laugh,
withdrawal
the wave crashes
symptoms,
and I look around me and see
when
only
you're
flocks
to stop
and jetsam.
Heroin.
Mm-hmm. Old
the point was, of course,
Tampax
that I hadn't
holders,
actually
empty bags
intra-
saying
never
Cheetos are made in Taiwan.
So,
but that wasn't happening.
It wasn't that
the wave
hard
wasn't
a habit
even
for me
beginning
to, kick.
To crash.
It was quite hard, but I did
so
it
I
with
said,
the help of
you know,
this,
folks,
this
there's a tradition that male painters get to take advantage of. A woman who's a
an addiction
model,
to drugs, an obsession with drugs
cook,
is
secretary,
kind of related
of course,
to, in a way, the same,
money,
kind, of, same kind of obsession that allows you to spend
all
as many hours as you must have
are
developing
growing
your guitar
up
playing.
Of being
Do you know what I mean? Because you've been obsessive
kind of
about guitar playing and
looking
about your
at
music.
Their bodies in mirrors
Absolutely.
Thinking,
There's no doubt about
maybe
it.
Some man would like to paint that.
I like
French
to look, think of my guitar,
tell them how to make
my,
really succulent
my love for
little
guitar
dishes
playing
out of horse
being
meat
dedicated.
With a lot of bay leaves and
but
wine.
But it's not far removed
preparing
from being
physically
obsessive.
And spiritually
I mean,
to carry his canvases to a hard-hearted gallery owner,
what
their muscles straining, their eyes brimming with shed or unshed tears.
Obviously my guitar playing took second place.
Now I ask you, mothers and fathers of America,
you know, one is
are
a
your boys dreaming
kind
of these things?
And the other
where,
one is a very unnatural,
I ask
unnatural
you, lovers
dedication.
Of the arts, where are the male muses?
Oh, I want to ask you something about
and he
your
stood
past,
up
about
just
your very
there
beginnings
in front of everyone.
I know you've
said,
talked about this, that your mother
right
had you, she
this
wasn't
reading
married.
That Mary Gordon, that's from Mary Gordon's
and
novel.
She
spending.
Left.
Well, this gentleman who stands up and says right here, he not only wants to be
who told you that they were actually your parents,
he wants to be her lover, he wants to be her benefactor.
You were told at first that she was your sister.
What made you think about what it would be like
for a woman? I'm wondering what effects do you think that had on your public identity? Do you know what I mean? On your public sense of self?
I think the general crabbiness.
It's very complicated,
that,
isn't it? I mean,
friends,
whatever the result was, has to be a complicated
another,
result, isn't it, when you think about it?
Fetched,
I've got so many
made
different
crabby, we've been fetching for years about
sides
why
of my nature as a result
get this
of that,
we don't.
That
what,
upbringing.
I mean, when is the balance going to be
I
tipped?
Think
and I
there's a side of me that
for life,
know, dreads
so
rejection,
I
dreads abandonment. There's another side that sort of loves solitude.
What connotations
I don't know. It's had all kinds of effects on me.
Well, it has the...
most of which I've kind of started to deal with
but also
over the last
of,
few years.
Of
and,
that
come to
nest
terms with
of things
it. If I
that is
can,
required
I parts
for
of my
an artist
that cause
to be
me
helped by
or
her or his
I at
work.
Least
that
accept
is to say,
them.
Someone but who provides
sure,
not only inspiration,
an unusual
but
upbringing, you know?
Makes a space
you said that at
in
some
the world,
point
gives
in your
you
career
space
that you,
and
you got bored with virtuoso
says,
musicianship.
You know,
what was the turning
important
point for you?
Is your work. I'm going
well,
to
that's,
make
I think that might have been a very glib way for me
work.
To say that I couldn't get it any better.
And what does this guy do to make
it possible the end of my capabilities, I think.
Well, he gives her money.
And a lot of people
and so she can
taking it further on, so I suppose I had to develop some kind of attitude about it. And it was
absolutely
better
on
off
her
my
own
face
schedule.
To say that
she
I was getting bored.
She can do whatever
bored,
she wants.
You know?
She can travel.
So after you felt you couldn't
wants,
take it any further, you wanted
to
turn to something
paintings
else.
Paintings in a particular place.
No,
he
I
provides
just
a,
realized
a
that
space
technically
for her to live
my
work
potential
in.
Was probably
he
had come to its end.
Pleasurable
you know? I
objects
I'm not that
for
nimble,
her to be
really.
Nourished by.
I don't think
he
I can compete on the sort of the fast, furious guitar
the space and the time and the money to devote
tended to go the other way.
To painting, the artist in
by
your
going
novel,
the other way, you mean singing more?
As the spent
yeah, singing more, or just kind of refining my Jesus technique
paintings.
To somewhere where I could simplify it and get more out of it
my,
with doing less.
Painter,
you know.
Whose name is Monica,
Eric Clapton,
is looking
recorded
at her lover
in 1989.
One night after they've made love, and the posture in which he's sitting seems familiar to her in a puzzling way. And it occurs to her that the way that he's sitting reminds her of a painting by Carpaccio of the dead Christ, and she has a revelation. She says, my God, maybe these dead Christs in Renaissance paintings weren't really dead. They were just post-orgasmic. And she decides to do a series of paintings based on the Italian masters called Spent Men of her lover in a post-orgasmic condition, but using the iconography of Christ in the Renaissance paintings.
What made you think of this?
I was looking at a show of Pontormo drawings in London one time, and I said, this guy's not dead. This guy's just been worn out from a hot night. And it was an absolute perception that amused me. What's really interesting is the Northern Christs look much more dead than the Italian Christs. And I just had fun thinking about that.
Mary Gordon, your early novels seem to be mostly about characters who were very repressed and very guilt-ridden about responsibilities to family, about other responsibilities. This character, it just wants to be totally absorbed in her paintings, and she there's a lot of sexuality in the new book. Many scenes where the painter and her lover are engaging in acts of passion. And I'm wondering, it seems to me your characters are becoming less inhibited and more sexual, and I'm wondering what that says about you as a writer as you're writing more about sexuality.
One of the things that I, again, wanted to rewrite, and I think maybe one of the things that I feel I stand for or wish to stand for more as a writer and I don't know, a human being, although the two are not necessarily unlinked, is I am very tired of duality. I'm very tired of an either or. And it seems to me if literature gives us anything, it's the opportunity to say not either or, but yes and. And so this character is, she's really committed to her work. She loves her work. She gets irritated if people get in the way of her work. But when her daughter gets mono, she puts her work down. She's a little crabby about it, but she does it. When her lover throws his back out, when her lover loses money and gets depressed, she is there for them. Not without ambivalence, but I guess I wanted to undo what I think is a particularly male fantasy about the artist, which is that there's this tremendous split between life and art, and that being a good person or a responsible person necessarily cuts into your artistic life. And I think that's a myth.
Let's get back to sex, though.
Okay.
Your character has a lot more sex than I think, you know, most of the previous characters. Most of the characters in previous books have, and she's very comfortable with that. And I'm wondering if you are more comfortable as a writer writing sexual scenes than you would have been early on as a writer.
I think that writing about sex is a little bit hard, and you have to feel your oats a little bit as a writer to feel that you have a right to do it. One of the things that I didn't realize till after I was finished was worrying about not being seen as a good girl writer anymore. That everybody had sort of thought of me as you know, really serious and really taking the moral high ground. And I was really writing about pleasure, particularly sexual pleasure. And while I was doing it, it was an interesting formal problem for me in a way, and something I was interested in writing about, so I wasn't worried about it. And it was only after the book was over that I realized that I was worried about not being seen as a serious good girl anymore. I think I probably couldn't have done that when I was younger. I think one of the hopeful things about getting older is you get less worried about being thought of as a good girl.
You know, your character, Monica, says that she hates talking about sex. She says, most words that connect up with sex have one kind of bad effect or another. Either I laugh or I want to become a Carmelite. Slang is not good. Scientific names are not good either. Then she runs down some of the names used for female genitals, and she thinks one sounds like a gum disease and another sounds like it was invented in the men's room of a bus station. How did you find the right words that you wanted to use, that you were comfortable with, that sounded sexy and not condescending or insulting to you? Because so many words, slang words that are used to describe women's bodies end up sounding nasty.
They do, and it was a real problem. I had to go through a lot of revisions, and finally I did do the slightly cop-out thing of saying I'm not going to use any of these words because they're tainted. But I realized that in my own conversation, I rarely would use those kinds of words. So I fudged it in that way. But I also was very interested in creating a new erotics that was really female. And it seems to me that female erotics are much more contextual than male erotics. And one of the things I did was I read a lot of Colette. And Colette very rarely names anything, but she creates a situation in which the objects surrounding the events are so erotically charged that they begin to give off a kind of musk of their own. And I realized I could be more explicit than Colette could be, but I wanted to create a sexualized, an eroticized, a richly voluptuous context so that the sex came from a place, not just sort of appearing from nowhere. And yet I didn't want to be coy. I didn't want to say, now we're going to draw the curtain. And so that was kind of a challenge.
Mary Gordon is my guest, and her new novel is called Spending. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Mary Gordon, and her new novel is called Spending. Now, you're writing about a comparatively older couple in this. The woman has already gone through menopause. So, you know, birth control isn't an issue for her. Pregnancy isn't an issue. She says, I was too old now to lose anything by it, to lose anything by sex. I almost certainly couldn't even get pregnant anymore. One of the things we could both count on was that we were past many things that once might have been at stake. Talk to me a little bit about that about writing about a couple that's older and is engaged in first-time sexual encounters with each other.
This is something that I'm actually rather hopeful about, and you know, my nature is not to be so hopeful. But I think that, and again, I'm talking about people who are fortunate, and I understand that a lot of people have had terrible situations. But I think that there is a cohort of us who went through the sexual liberation of the 60s, went through the women's movement. We have our own identity through work, not just through who we are in the eyes of men. We're not young, but we're still peppy, and we might even look good. Some of us, oddly enough, look better than we did at 20. And I think that because, you know, a lot of us know, even if you made a sexual mistake, your life is not going to be ruined by it. I mean, unless you get killed, which is another popular motif in writing about women and sex. But supposing that you don't get killed, you have too much in your life that's in place to have it ruined by sex. And that, in conjunction with some of the other good things that have accreted through a life, gives you an odd new freedom and energy sexually, I think.
So you're talking about all the anxiety that was involved for a lot of women in their early sexual encounters, where it was related so much to their personal identity and to fear of getting pregnant, fear of being found out. Fear of being hurt by...
Fear of being hurt, fear of marrying the wrong person or not marrying the wrong person or not getting married or, you know, getting, as you say, getting pregnant or not getting pregnant. And once you... Being beloved, and if you're not beloved, then you were a whore. All those things are... If they're out of the way, there's a lot of nice open space.
Over the past year or so, there's been a lot of controversy about the form of the memoir. Are writers being honest when they write about their lives? Are the memories that they have accurate memories? Do the writers become exhibitionists by, you know, not only revealing intimate details about their own lives, but intimate details about the lives of friends and family who are unwillingly being drawn into a public eye? Is there no longer any discretion about issues that should remain private? You wrote a memoir before writing this new novel, and I'm wondering if you felt that there were any surprising after effects from having revealed very personal things about yourself and your family.
Well, I was in an odd situation with my family, in which practically everybody was dead that I was writing about, and my mother is suffering from a very advanced form of dementia, and so. You know, she had no memory and really no awareness that I was doing this. The fallout from this book was surprisingly positive and wonderful, extra literary, in that I found a new family. I hooked up with some distant cousins of my father's, and who have really embraced me and taken me in. And given me a kind of connection to that Jewish part of my life that I hadn't had. So again, I was very lucky. I didn't feel that I was revealing anything that could hurt anybody. And so the fallout from it was completely positive. And some people were shocked about things that I said about my mother. But on the other hand, many people who were experiencing a kind of thing that I had experienced with my mother, which is seeing somebody falling apart through dementia or Alzheimer's, were very, very grateful to me for having named the things. So again, I had this odd, you know, I'm often in very odd situations in my life, which are lucky. So is it lucky that practically everybody in your family is dead? You know, maybe that's an odd kind of good luck. But for writing a memoir, the dead are a lot less trouble than the living. And then I got this wonderful, wonderful gift of a new family.
You mentioned that with
Jeff Bridges
is
starring in the new Coen Brothers film, The Big Lebowski.
You've learned
he's part of an acting family.
His brother is Beau Bridges.
Jewish aspects
their
of your family.
Lloyd Bridges,
your father
died
was Jewish, and although
it's later found out when you were writing
we're
your
going
memoir,
to hear an excerpt of a 1993 interview
some very
in which Jeff
things.
Looked back on growing up during the
your
years.
Your mother was
his father
Catholic. Your father
was spending a lot of time underwater, shooting a TV series, Sea Hunt,
expecting to become a nun. So what has it been like for you to learn more about the
series? Ran from 1957 to
61. Your side of your family.
Can we go back to the beginning? Talk
As
about
I
your,
get
your
older,
early days.
I'm really interested
sure.
in
okay.
a life.
I know. I have
of
to confess
amplitude.
To you that, like a lot of,
so,
I'm about your
as I
age.
Explore
I mean, you're younger.
The part
than
of
you are.
My
so,
history
so, like a lot of people, I'm sure
Jewish.
You've heard this
it's
from
not,
a lot of people. I grew up watching Sea Hunt.
Right.
That's right.
I grew up living in an apartment
part.
Building in Brooklyn,
it
New York, but I knew how to prevent getting the bends.
And they're very contradictory.
Very good.
Yeah, like this is going to be real useful information to me.
Opening up. Can you hum the Sea Hunt theme?
Gosh, you know, I don't think I can.
It's a world of
go ahead,
enrichment and a world of complexity.
Something
I guess
like
what
that.
William James, called, James
there,
called the buzz and bloom of implication.
No, were your friends, did they watch the show and
that,
did that mean
that
anything
I feel
to you?
Literature can do that,
oh,
that
yeah,
nothing else can
sure,
do. Because the opposite of literature is not life,
the show,
but the soundbite.
A lot of them like
and
you know,
what does the soundbite do? What do religious fundamentalists do but flatten the world and make it less complicated?
All in all, this.
Ideally, as you grow older, you see how complicated it is.
You were on some episodes when you were a kid. How old were you, and what were the scenes? What did you have to do?
You were a kid, and you were really, you know, on a mission.
is religion for you now a kind of cultural, intellectual expression, or do you practice any aspects of Catholicism?
I do go to church.
My neighbor, Andy Kaplan, was playing my
You know, I try to go to churches that aren't going to put me into a murderous rage, which, if you're Catholic, is not always easy.
Swim under there and save us.
I go to the synagogue on high holy days as a kind of witness.
Maybe if we sing, they'll hear us and they'll save us.
But I definitely think of myself as
underwater.
This was an underwater cave.
This was a
cave. It's like, you know, the tide is rising, you know, and trapped us in this cave.
Like-minded people who
I remember being thrown off Malibu
again,
Pier
more
in the middle of winter,
and I think more mature and
having to say my lines with the cold water,
and more humorous and, you know, version of the church than is coming out of
whose
the
idea
Vatican
was it
right
for you
now
to do the episodes or was it your father's?
So I have a
it was my dad's.
Important to me.
You know,
one of the things that I like about
part in here, you
want to
do
a religious
it, and,
life is. In church, you see people that can all be together in one place that wouldn't be together in a building for any
other
reason.
Your brother Bo Bridges is 9 years older than you. Did he ever have to take care of you when you were young?
You don't have to be
distinguished to get in. Did you, like, tag along with him and his friends against
his will? You don't have to earn your place there. You don't have to be good looking. You don't have to be smart.
Being 8 years older,
you don't have to be successful. You don't even have to be sane or clean. You just have to be there. And I like being sort of under a roof with people who are very different, who are all
you know, I looked up to him
aspiring to, in general,
he was always so
thing
great in sports.
Well, Mary Gordon, I really want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
He was scouted by the Dodgers. You know,
Mary Gordon's new novel is called
UCLA
Spending.
Basketball team, and for a guy who is, you know, I think he's about 5'10 or 11, you know, he was playing out there with Walt Hazard and all those guys. And, you know, he taught me how to do all those sports and box and everything. So he was a, you know, yeah, I really did look up to him. He really was my hero. And then he taught me how to act, and we would do, we used to do this thing, this idea we came up with where, you know, so often you talk to actors and they say, you know, it's tough because we need an audience, you know, and there's no audience. You can't just act in your room by yourself. That's not gratifying at all. So what Bo and I would do is we'd rent a flatbed truck, and we would play the supermarket circuit. We would get a few scenes together, and we would go into a supermarket parking lot, and we would get on the back of the flatbed truck, and we would act, and we would get people to all come around and watch our show and improvise and do kind of crazy things until the cops would come, and then we'd try to include the cops in the show, and they would kind of get flustered, and then one of us would get in the driver's seat and drive off to the next supermarket.
So it's kind of a strange thing to do, follow a flatbed truck to a supermarket parking lot and put on a little show. What did people make of it?
I don't know. You know, sometimes we would start it with a fight. You know, my father taught us how to fake fight, you know, do stage fighting. So sometimes we would start it with a fight, you know, to get people saying, what's happening, to get a crowd around us. And then we would say, we're just kidding. We're going to put on a show. And then they'd gather around. It's a good idea. I recommend it highly for all you actors out there who need an audience.
Now, one of your early films was the remake of King Kong.
Mm-hmm.
Did it turn out like you expected?
Oh, not really. You know, I was a big fan of the original. I remember, you know, faking sick just to get out of school to see that thing. You know, I love that original movie.
Me too.
And it worked all right. I mean, it was tough. A tough acting assignment to have to do all that, you know, with all the technical stuff, because that the acting kind of takes a back seat to that.
Did you have to do a lot of scenes in which there was a mechanical ape arm playing opposite you?
I did a few of those, but I remember being on the set when Jessica Lange was in this hand. And God, the camera should have been turned the other way, because I've never had this feeling, a combination of horror and laughing my head off, seeing the director, who was this English guy, directing these five Italians. Each man had a finger on this giant, had a control that controlled the finger of this huge gorilla paw. And Jesse was in this paw, and he finally, you know, he couldn't couldn't communicate with these guys in words, so he finally said, just look at my bloody hand. And he stuck his hand up in the air. He had all these five Italian guys looking at his hand, trying to, you know, figure out how much he should squeeze the fingers. And Jessica almost got crushed several times. I mean, you know, it was very painful for her. Terrible situation.
I hear you laughing.
Yeah, well, it's very, very strange.
I've got one last question for you.
Yay.
Did you ever get the bends?
Did I ever get the bends? No, but I've had nitrogen narcosis several times.
Have you really?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, I haven't, but I would like to have.
Did you ever go deep sea diving?
Yes, to get nitrogen narcosis. I've been skin diving. Yeah, especially when my dad was doing Sea Hunt, we would go skin diving quite a bit, and also scuba diving.
Jeff Bridges recorded in 1993. You can see Jeff Bridges in the new movie The Big Lebowski. His father, Lloyd Bridges, died Tuesday at the age of 85.